Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Judas is actually in a totally revised relationship to Jesus. He is Jesus's favored disciple. He is the person who enables Jesus to reach the heavens, and he himself is a star in the sky, according to, you know, the words of Jesus.
That's Herb Krosny, author of The Lost Gospel, talking about the Gospel of Judas with National Public Radio. Well, the Gospel of Judas and, in today's conversation, the Gospel of Peter, they are ancient documents. So there's no two ways about it. But do they say what many scholars say that they say, especially with regard to the Gospel of Judas? Does it recast Judas as the favored disciple? Or have we been perhaps the victim of several egregious translation errors? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Thursday afternoon, the 28th of January. It'll be part three of our series on the New Testament manuscripts today, the Gospels of Judas and Peter. Dr. Craig Evans, author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts, will be our guest. Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness joins us after that. We'll talk about President Biden and the U.S. military. We'll discuss demographic trends on fatherlessness and childlessness with Dr. Alan Carlson of the International Organization for the Family. And then Joy Pullman will be alongside. We'll answer the question, what you should know about using the Google search engine, when we discuss, well, not only alternatives to Google, but what Google's doing to control what you can and can't see on the internet. Joining us for part three of our series on the New Testament manuscripts today, the Gospels of Judas and Peter, Dr. Craig Evans. He's Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University and author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the discovery of the Gospel of Judas.
Well, it's enshrouded with mystery because we don't even know which year it was found. We think it was 1978. Someone was exploring a cave in Egypt. It was probably a Coptic Christian burial cave from antiquity. Anyway, went inside, found some things, took some things. And one of the things that this individual took was a small stone box that contained some old books. And one of these books, we now call the Chaikos Codex, contained the Gospel of Judas and a few other related Gnostic writings. We think that was 1978. We think it eventually found its way north to Cairo, where it fell into the hands of an antiquities dealer who became aware, because of all the talk about the Nag Hammadi codices that had been published very recently, that these old writings could be valuable. And so one thing led to another, someone trying to get $1 million for it. Scholars became aware of it, but there was no sale. The asking price was too high. And unfortunately, the Chaikos Codex wound up in a deep freezer in New York. The owner, thinking that it was damaged by humidity and mold and that sort of thing, maybe it should be freeze-dried, and that damaged it severely because papyrus is not supposed to be below freezing. It damages the natural resin and fibers. The paper became brown, dark brown, brittle, began to crack. And then once again, people were trying to sell it. So it's a very convoluted story. I heard at the beginning of the program, you quoted Herb Krosny. I know Herb. He wrote a very good book on how the Chaikos Codex became known and was recovered, restored by National Geographic. And of course, the centerpiece that got all the attention was the Gospel of Judas. So it's a very convoluted story, but at least it wound up in the hands of National Geographic. They spent more than $1 million restoring it. It's back in Egypt where it originally came from. And it's been much talked about, much published, and debated ever since.
So what is the manuscript evidence for the Gospel of Judas? Is it just that one codex?
Yeah, that's it. That's the only manuscript we have. However, the Church Fathers talk about it. And the most important reference is by probably the most important second century Church Father, and that's Irenaeus, in the context of talking about the four New Testament Gospels, which he respected, considered apostolic, trustworthy, and authoritative. He criticizes the many other Gospels that float around, some under apostolic names. And he specifically mentions the Gospel of Judas, and he describes it very accurately. And so the Gospel of Judas that has been recovered, and we should not assume that this is the only version of it, probably was originally written in Greek, probably edited, then gets paraphrased and translated into Coptic, and that's what we have. But nonetheless, it's very close to what Irenaeus described. In other words, Judas seemed to have secrets, seemed to be the best of the disciples, seems to in some way assist Jesus in accomplishing redemption by betraying Jesus. And so it goes. However, the initial interpretation that Judas is being portrayed as a hero who ascends into the heavens and all that, that is highly questionable. And that's what the debate is today.
Okay, so we'll get into that debate in a minute. But on the face of it, what story does the Gospel of Judas purport to tell?
Well, what it does is Judas seems to be singled out as the disciple who has the best understanding. This is very similar to the Gospel of Thomas that we've already talked about, where Jesus asked the disciples, what am I like, you know, and what do you think? And Peter has an idea, Matthew has an idea, and then Thomas says, well, my mouth can't even describe you. And so then Jesus says, well, then come over here privately, and he shares things with Thomas that can't be shared with anyone else. Well, we get the same scenario in the Gospel of Judas. He seems to be the one who has the deeper insight, and so Jesus invites him over for private disclosure. And then the rest of the Gospel is basically that. Judas asking Jesus questions, Jesus telling him the typical Gnostic kind of things about different layers of heaven and what's going to happen in the future and escaping this corrupt, bad earth below that's going to collapse. And of course, Judas wonders, well, what advantage do I have? You know, will I escape all this? And this, of course, is where the debate comes into play, because when the Chaco's Codex was originally found, about 15% of the Judas Gospel was missing. And so, well, who is the one who ascends into the luminous cloud? Who actually goes up into heaven? That's where a lot of the debate developed. But that's what it is. It's a story where Judas appears to know more than the other disciples. Jesus laughs at the other disciples. It's very anti-Semitic. They're like the Jews. They sacrifice animals. But you, Judas, you will exceed them all because you will sacrifice the man who clothes me. And that is the physical Jesus in which the Logos or the spiritual Jesus resides. So that, what does that mean? You know, exceed the other disciples in a good way or exceed them all in a bad way?
Okay, does the Gospel of Judas have any impact on serious Bible scholarship or on Christian theology?
It really doesn't. What the Gospel of Judas does help us understand is the variety of eccentric interpretations, non-apostolic interpretations that began to emerge in the second century. Christianity did not simply come on the scene in a vacuum. There were competing ideas already floating about, some Jewish, some not, some into just completely different worldviews. And the Christian story intrigued people. We actually have evidence that novelists were intrigued by the story of the discovery of the empty tomb, for example, and Jesus appearing post-mortem and all that. So the Christian story created a lot of interest, and some of that interest was expressed in very strange ways. And so you had people, I don't even know if we should call them Christian, but they were interested in the Christian story. They just wanted to improve on it. They wanted to tell it in different ways. The Gospel of Judas, like the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, and on we could go, it just wanted to portray Jesus and the disciples, in this case especially Judas, in a whole new light.
So you say that there are four egregious errors in the translation of Judas that have led to an erroneous interpretation. What are those errors one by one?
Well, one of them is Jesus refers to Judas as a spirit. That's how it's translated. But the actual word, it's a loan word from Greek, is demon. Well, you know, in Jewish and Christian texts, demon is never good. But in Greco-Roman texts, it's more or less neutral. It can be good, it can be bad, it can be something else. It's more like just simply saying a spirit. And so they're trying to make it sound like Jesus is paying Judas a compliment. Well, that's most unlikely that calling Judas Iscariot in this gospel a demon is meant to be a compliment. But it's portrayed as though that's a really good thing. And I think that's the first mistake that this text makes.
There's another one in this list of four, and it is a whether or not Judas's words should be set apart for or separated from. What is that about?
Yeah, that's right. And that is crucial. And, you know, has he been set apart for something that's good, or has he been separated from what is good? And again, I think the original edition just goes the wrong way. And Coptic scholars, once it was published, immediately jumped on it. We're talking about 2006. Immediately jumped on it, and that led to a new edition coming out. And no, Judas is not being set apart for the heaven above. He's been separated from it. So, and that's why he then turns around and asks in context, well, then what's my advantage? If he had been told, hey, don't worry, you're going to go to heaven, he wouldn't say that. But if Jesus has told him, you know, I'm sorry, Judas, but the door's closed on you too, well, then that's exactly what we would expect him to say. Well, what advantage is it for me then? And so I think that's another mistake in the original translation and interpretation that was offered by the team that restored the text and commented upon it back in 2006.
Another one of these errors is ascend versus not ascend. What do we find there, Dr. Evans?
Yeah, that's just an out-and-out mistranslation. It flat outright says he will not ascend above, you know, where the God of light is, where Jesus presumably is going to ascend also. And many Coptic experts pointed that out and said that is just plain wrong. And so that was the third mistake. And of course, it goes on to talk about, you know, speculating that Judas Iscariot is the one that enters the luminous cloud. And that's based upon that mistaken interpretation. And of course, then the fourth error, which I think, you know, you're leading up to, is what is the meaning of you will exceed them all? That is not intended to be a compliment. It basically says you're going to be worse than the other disciples. They are like the Jews who sacrifice animals, but you're actually going to sacrifice a human being, the very human being who has lent his body to me that I'm wearing like a suit right now. And you're gonna betray him. And of course, that's how it ends. It turns out Jesus is right. That's exactly what he does. He leaves the body, and it is Jesus who ascends into the luminous cloud. And then sure enough, Judas Iscariot betrays for money the physical Jesus to the ruling priest.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. He's author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. We're talking with him about the Gospels of Judas and Peter when we come back. Given that it's a Gnostic text and correcting these errors, what is the most likely interpretation of the Gospel of Judas?
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes. Dedicated customer service and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
Casting Christ's net on the internet. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Sent to serve. Across the nation, children are back in 1,900 Lutheran schools serving students in early childhood through high school. Whether in person or through remote learning, students are thriving in programs of excellence in safe, caring Christian environments taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. That's lcms.org/schools.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Part three of our series on the New Testament manuscripts today, the Gospels of Judas and Peter. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, distinguished professor of Christian origins and the dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University and author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. Dr. Evans, given the fact that we're dealing here with the Gospel of Judas as a Gnostic text and correcting those errors in translation that we mentioned before the break, what is the most likely interpretation of the Gospel of Judas?
I think it's a serious criticism of the emerging proto-Orthodox Church, which is, of course, pro-Jewish, pro-Old Testament. It is very pro-Jesus in his original setting as a Jewish Messiah and fulfiller of the ancient Hebrew scriptures. That is just not of interest to Gnostics. And so someone came up with a rather diabolically clever way of mocking the early church from that point of view by suggesting that the so-called betrayer, Judas Iscariot, actually was the best of a bad lot. Keep in mind that there was a movement within Gnosticism of the second and third centuries. They're called the Cainites, and this is what Irenaeus, we talked about the second century church father before the break, Irenaeus, he knows of the Gospel of Judas. And he says it was composed by the Cainites. Now, that's referring to Cain in Genesis, who murdered his brother Abel. Now, that's very important to know that because the Cainite Gnostics believe that all of the bad guys in the Old Testament are, in fact, good guys persecuted by the evil God. Remember, these Gnostics believe there are two gods, a good God who's a God of light and spirit up above, but a bad God, the God of this world, who created this world and uses it almost like you could say a prison house and to keep people who otherwise have sparks of light and insight, Gnostics in other words, to keep them in a drunken stupor and not be aware of who they are so they might escape. Because if the sparks of light all escape this earth, the earth will collapse. So it's like losing his power and his energy. What they do is they just, it's an interesting hermeneutic, they just turn the Old Testament story inside and out, so good guys become bad guys become good guys. And so Cain is in fact a good guy, not a bad guy. The people of Sodom and Gomorrah who are destroyed by fire, well, they were destroyed because God is jealous and they had knowledge, and so they were destroyed with fire. The serpent in the Garden of Eden is not bad, it's good. It's trying to explain to Adam and Eve what knowledge is. He wants them to eat from the tree of knowledge. It's the jealous God who does not want them to. And so they eat from the tree of knowledge, and then they realize, hey, they understand what's going on. And then, of course, God, the bad God, seeks them out and says, where are you? And, of course, the Gnostic says, can you imagine that? God doesn't even know where they are. And anyway, that's what's going on. And the Gospel of Judas clearly seems to reflect that. And so Judas, the betrayer, isn't, in fact, the worst of the disciples. He's actually a good guy. He's actually a tool. He's been used by Jesus. Now, of course, the disciples are hopeless, all of them. And Judas, in a sense, is the best of a bad lot. He ends up sacrificing the human being that accommodates the spirit of Jesus, and that's very Gnostic as well. Jesus descends from heaven, borrows a body, uses it for a while, finds his disciples, and so forth. But unfortunately, the original 12, they're all beguiled by Jewish thinking, and they don't really know what's going on. And so Jesus has to tell them the truth. You know, none of you will make it, not even you, Judas. You won't make it either. So that's what it is. It's a turning on the head, the biblical story, making the good guys the bad guys. And that's why Judas is the one picked out to be the so-called hero in the story.
Do these Gnostic texts in 1st, 2nd century Gnosticism, does it matter to them whether these texts are historical or not? Or are they simply making a point using the cast from the canonical gospels?
I think it's mostly the latter, as you put it. You know, they are making a point, and they're using biblical figures, or in this case, gospel figures, Jesus and his disciples. But I do think they think that it's historical. They think it's the truth. They think that it's the inside skinny. Some of it's private, most of it's private, and that's why these stories and teachings are not found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And that's because it's private, and that's certainly how the proto-Orthodox react. They think that that's what these Gnostics are claiming, that here's the real truth. This is what the historical Jesus actually taught. And so they react. They don't just say it's a bad interpretation. They react by saying it's bad and false history. These things did not happen. Jesus did not say these things. So that's how they react. They're changing the story. They want it to fit their... It's kind of a Neoplatonism that was very much in vogue in the second and third centuries. And so they just want to portray Jesus differently with a different message.
The existence of things like the Gospel of Judas do, however, appear to attest to the early circulation of the canonical texts. They seem to be very well known there in the second century.
Oh, yeah, you're right on that. It's presupposed. Like we talked about Thomas last time, you know, these are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke. Well, yeah, that's right. And just the way it begins, it presupposes that the non-secret, the public words of Jesus are well known. And so these gospels are written not so much as a replacement of the public gospels, but a furtherance of them, an elaboration, and maybe a correction too. And so these, you know, you have your public gospels. Well, now you can go into the deeper truth, what these secret gospels have to say. And by the way, that's the same idea about what we call the Old Testament pseudepigrapha. This is actually stated in a book called 4th Ezra, where it says, you know, the Holy Spirit enabled Ezra and his fellow scribes to copy out the Old Testament. And these books are public. Anybody can read them, the wise or the unwise. But these other 70 books that have been written out, and that's the pseudepigrapha, like the Book of Enoch and so on, only the wise, only the privileged insiders can read them. Well, that's the same idea that's going on in these Gnostic writings as they relate to the New Testament.
Since it's found in a codex, one of these ancient books, it is fascinating to consider that there were Gnostics gathering their own scriptures all parallel to the Christian scriptures in the early Christian era.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, I think there's another dynamic at work, too. This is only in more recent years becoming appreciated. It isn't just that we want a book or that we want to have a collection of writings that more or less parallel what the proto-Orthodox are doing as they gather their Paul's letters into a codex or the Gospels into a codex. The book itself is a talisman. The book itself is like a phylactery or a lucky rabbit's foot. And that's why we find these books in burial caves. The Nag Hammadi books, codices, were not found in a jar by the Nile River. That was a myth that looters made up, they were stolen from Coptic Christian burial caves. That's where we found the Chagos Codex as well. The Bruce Codex also, the Askew Codex also, the Akbim Codex that contained the Gospel of Peter. They were all found in tombs. And so I think what was happening is that these books were being produced almost like holy relics or talismans that would protect you from bad things, evil spirits or whatever.
We're talking with Dr. Craig Evans. It's part three of our series on the New Testament manuscripts today, the Gospel of Judas. And when we come back, we will talk about the Gospel of Peter. He is author of the book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. When you purchase Jesus and the Manuscripts using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Talk On Demand Archives, and look for Jesus and the Manuscripts by Dr. Craig Evans. On the other side of the break, we'll find out how the Gospel of Peter was discovered and its manuscript evidence. Stay tuned. You could win recordings of all 10 Making the Case conferences and recordings of more than 50 hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir. Here's how. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts. Copy and paste the text of your review and send it to talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll announce the winners on February 1st. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts. And send your review to talkback@issuesetc.org.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. simplyclassical.com.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our trek through Matthew with faithful and unfaithful servants, parable of the 10 virgins, parable of the talents, parts 1 and 2, and last judgment, part 1. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcast weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider our beach house. A charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back. back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the Gospels of Judas and Peter with Dr. Craig Evans, author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. So, Dr. Evans, tell us about the discovery of the Gospel of Peter.
Well, the Gospel of Peter was found, the same thing, in a tomb during an excavation in North Africa at a place we call Akhmim, and in the winter of 1886-87. And it was a French archaeological team. There were several books, again, found in a box. I think it's the same idea that we were talking about a little while ago with respect to the Chaikos Codex and the Gospel of Judas, and just a different, basically the same time, but a different location. And the Codex is probably dated to the 6th or 7th century, and surprise, surprise, inside was found a fragment of another gospel that had been talked about in the late 2nd century, and that's the Gospel of Peter. Included with it was a large fragment of a work known as the Apocalypse of Peter, and also a big chunk in Greek of the Book of Enoch. So it was quite a find. And eventually, the Gospel of Peter was published. We think it's Peter simply because Peter speaks in the first person. I, Peter, you know, he's witnessed these things. And so we have reason to believe it really is the Gospel of Peter that the church father Eusebius talks about in the early 4th century. He talks about a bishop, Serapion, 200 years earlier, who forbade churches in Syria, you know, from reading it. Apparently, he allowed it to be read in the churches. Then he discovered that there were some false statements in it, and he says, quit reading it. So anyway, we have a little bit of information about the Gospel of Peter from church fathers, and then we have a chunk of it now. It begins with Pilate washing his hands, and he gives Jesus up to be crucified, and it ends with a spectacular resurrection account. Pilate and the Jewish elders, very nervous when they discover that, you know what, we made a big mistake. We crucified the Son of God. So it's an interesting text. It's full of exaggeration and excess, and in my opinion, which I think now is the majority view, it really is a second century text. It is not early.
What is the manuscript evidence for the Gospel of Peter? Just that single text?
Well, probably. It's debated because we have two other small fragments of papyrus recovered from Oxyrhynchus. There are some scholars who think they're tiny little pieces of the Gospel of Peter. I don't think so, and some of the major studies on Peter in recent years have concluded that there is no reason to think so. But in a way, it doesn't change anything because most agree that the Akhmim Codex, that dates to the 6th or 7th century, probably is a copy of the 2nd century Gospel of Peter. So even these small fragments don't really add anything, and if we say that they're not part of Peter, nothing really is lost.
John Dominic Cresson of the Jesus Seminar was for some time, I don't know if he still does, suggesting that the Gospel of Peter was source material for the canonical Gospels. What do you make of that claim?
Yeah, I know that, and I've debated Dom many times. He's a great guy. He's an Irish-American, a former monk, by the way. Anyway, he has argued for years that the Gospel of Peter, it's not in its original form, but it contains an earlier form, which he dubs the Cross Gospel. He thinks that it originated in the 50s, which would make it, you know, the middle of the first century, makes it very early, and that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four of the New Testament Gospels, made use of its passion account. I think he couldn't be more wrong. It's a gratuitous move to take a text that exists and to say, actually, I can extract from it something earlier and older. There's no reason for that. There's no reason to think it ever existed any other way. It is shot through and through with second century ideas and traditions. And most scholars today rightly argue that what we have, the Gospel of Peter, is based on the four synoptic Gospels, especially based on Matthew and its story of the guard posted at the tomb.
So you say that the Gospel of Peter reflects a tradition, and I was unaware of this, of pagan authors adopting scenes or themes from the canonical Gospels to their own fictitious purposes. Tell us about this phenomenon, and then what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a great, really interesting thing. It didn't come from biblical scholars. It came from a very well-known, a very distinguished classicist who remarked on the coincidence. Early Christianity becomes well-known in Rome in the 40s to the point where Paul can write himself a letter to a well-established church in Rome in the 50s. And, of course, we all know that Christians get blamed for the fire that took place in the 60s, and Emperor Nero launched a vicious campaign and persecution of the Christians. So this classicist said, you know, Christianity is known in Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire, as early as the 40s. And isn't it interesting that within just a few years, Greek novelists, Greek and Latin novelists, invent a new literary theme. He called it in German Scheintod, which means apparent death. And it's where everybody's unhappy and grieving, a loved one, a girlfriend, a wife, a spouse, a husband, whatever, is buried, and then the next day they come back to mourn at the tomb, and the stone has been rolled aside, and the tomb is empty. And then rumors go everywhere. What has happened? Has someone stolen the body? What's happened? And then the presumed dead person is seen alive. And it becomes a really interesting story theme, and there are three or four novels that are extant from antiquity where that theme is there. And so he says, you know what, this what's happened is these non-Christian novelists have heard the Christian story, find it fascinating, and have added it to their arsenal of storytelling devices. And the Gospel of Peter picks up on it, does the same thing in order to develop an apologetic that shows that there was all this fascination with the empty tomb, and Jesus was seen alive, seen resurrected by hostile witnesses galore. And so it's an apologetic designed to defend the truth of the resurrection from skeptics.
So in other words, that would account for the fictionalizing aspects of the Gospel of Peter, the exaggerated character of it.
I think so. I think it's as one scholar put it, it's come full circle. The Christian proclamation of the empty tomb and the risen Jesus prompts this interesting response on the part of non-Christian Greeks and Romans who write novels. They incorporated it. It's very popular. And then the fictional author of Peter, he incorporates some of that same approach in his retelling of the gospel story. And so he has people running around, seeing the tomb, rumors about amazing things that were seen. And so it's like Christianity has affected secular culture. Secular culture, in turn, affects Christianity. So it comes back to a very exaggerated account of the resurrection in what we call the Gospel of Peter.
What other things about the Gospel of Peter indicate an authorship late rather than early?
Oh, there are many, many things. One of them is what's called polymorphic Christology. That is where the risen Christ takes different shapes. He's seen in different ways. He can look like an old man, a young child. And one of the popular themes was for Jesus to be really tall, like a tower. And you get metaphorical Christian writings. The Shepherd of Hermas would be one example. There are others where Jesus is likened to a tower and people look up at him. And in the Gospel of Peter, when he's raised from the dead, two angels go into the tomb and escort him out of the tomb. And we're told that the heads of the angels reach the clouds and the head of Jesus goes actually above the clouds. Well, that's an example of that, a giant Jesus. And another indicator is Jesus and his cross are always together. We have writings from the second century that talk about the second coming, Jesus returning to earth in power and glory, and the cross is coming with him. And sure enough, when he comes out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter, the cross comes out with him. And how exactly it ambulates, we're not told, but it follows Jesus. And the cross can not only walk, it can talk, because the heavenly voice then speaks, "Have you preached to them that sleep?" That is, has Jesus proclaimed the good news to the dead? And it isn't Jesus who answers the heavenly voice, it's the cross that then answers and says yes. Well, this is all second century tradition.
Then, if you would, it sounds like it's a fanciful apologetic. Tell us about the second century pagan critics of the resurrection to which Peter may be responding.
Yeah, that's a great question. Origen, in the third century, writes a lengthy response to a fellow named Celsus, who was writing around the year 160. And Celsus in 160 was just critiquing Christianity, just said, it's not believable. If Jesus were really divine, why would he allow anyone to beat him up and crucify him? If Jesus, if this is true and he really was resurrected, then why didn't more people see it? Your witnesses are not believable, he says. You have two women, at best two women, and he's referring to Mary Magdalene and another woman. And he says, your principal witness is a woman who's insane. She had seven demons, as you yourselves admit, seven demons cast out of her. She's from a wretched little village. I mean, he just piles it on. And he says, if your story was true, Jesus would have been seen alive by the very people who persecuted him, but that's not what happened. Well, the Gospel of Peter answers that. I think the Gospel of Peter, very shortly thereafter, is written. And so the Roman soldiers all see the resurrection take place. You know, if you read Matthew, and only Matthew says there's a guard, and in Matthew, when the resurrection event occurs, the guards just faint. They just drop to the ground. They don't see anything. But in Peter, nobody faints. And they see these two tall angels go into the tomb. They see these two tall angels bring the tall Jesus out of the tomb. They see it all. And the Jewish elders have done a sleepover right there by the grave. They're there. They see it too. The male disciples off in a distance, they see it. And so the witnesses to the risen Jesus plus angels that come and go, it's really laid on thick in the Gospel of Peter. And I think it's designed to answer the skepticism expressed by Celsus, and that is, why should anybody believe your story of the resurrection? It's just witnessed by a couple of frightened women. And this answers that, I think, overboard, but that's what it's doing. It's answering that objection.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Thursday, January the 28th. It's part three of our series on the New Testament manuscripts today, the Gospels of Judas and Peter. Stay tuned. If you appreciate Issues Etc., our 24/7 music and talk stations, and our daily verse-by-verse Bible study, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
You shall not commit adultery. What does this mean? We should fear and love God so that we lead a chaste and decent life in what we say and do, and husband and wife love and honor each other. Thus, Martin Luther explains the sixth commandment, you shall not commit adultery. This month's issue of the Lutheran Witness takes up these topics and discusses homosexuality, transgenderism, and our own struggle to live a chaste and decent life. Pick up your copy today of the Lutheran Witness at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our Christian faith is under constant attack, and we must be proactive in keeping our children in the church. At Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, we believe that an education rooted in God's Word is one that stands against the very gates of hell. Nothing in this world is more important. Offering a rigorous classical Lutheran education, we provide in-person and live online remote learning opportunities for preschool through grade 12. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Thanks to Matthew, Jeanette, and Steve for submitting reviews of Issues Etc. today with Apple Podcast. Winners of our Subscribe, Rate, and Review Apple Podcast contest will receive recordings of more than 50 hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir, recordings of all 10 Making the Case conferences, our book, Objections Overruled, and the LPR bundle package. We'll announce the winners on Monday, February 1st. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about the Gospels of Judas and Peter. You were talking before about this ancient critic of Christianity, Celsus. It strikes me, Dr. Evans, that that criticism, well, witnessed only by a couple women, actually is a great apologetic point for the truth of the gospel accounts in the canonical gospels. In other words, if they were making it up, they would have had crowds of witnesses all around the tomb, like the Gospel of Peter does.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that point has been made by scholars. The Gospel of Peter is a wonderful example of how something would be written, telling it the way you might think it should be told instead of according to the truth. And so you have this restraint, and that's the way I describe it. You have this restraint seen in the four New Testament Gospels where, yeah, it would sure be nice to exaggerate, but I can't. Well, yeah, it would sure be nice to pile on the witnesses, but this is what happened. And so I think what the Gospel of Peter does, it was not its intention, but by contrast, it highlights the four canonical Gospels in the way they exhibit verisimilitude. They reflect the way things really are, and a restraint. Because, you know, the Gospel of Peter just pulls all the stops out and blows it, because it imagines the Jewish elders doing a sleepover for two nights in a cemetery. Well, anybody who knows Judaism of the first century knows that because of the avoidance of corpse impurity, the fear of, you know, spirits in a cemetery, nobody is going to spend the night in a cemetery. But the author, the second century author of the Gospel of Peter, doesn't know that. In fact, another thing, just to make the same point, Celsus doesn't know first century Israel very well either. He knows that Mary is from Magdala, and he calls it a wretched little village. Well, that's like calling La Jolla or Laguna Beach in California a wretched little village. It was a very nice shoreline village on the Sea of Galilee. We know that now through excavations and so on, but Celsus didn't know that. You can always make the contrast between first century Gospels who know what they're talking about compared to later works, whether they're pro-Christian or anti-Christian, and they don't know what they're talking about.
So there's a lot of material here, but how is the Gospel of Peter related to what you call the Matthean or Matthew's apologetic?
Well, Matthew, of course, very early on is responding to the allegation that the disciples stole the body of Jesus. Now, what would be their motive? Well, if nothing else, Jesus has been placed not in his family tomb, not in a place of honor. That's the condemnation that happens when somebody has been executed. They're denied honorable burial for a period of 1 year. Now, a year later, everything's okay. You can gather up the bones of the deceased and take them to a place of honor. That was the Jewish law, Jewish custom. And so you can imagine critics, unbelievers and skeptics saying, oh, Jesus wasn't raised up, his tomb was found empty, not because of resurrection, but because the disciples, understandably, his family, whatever, took his body illegally and took it to a nice place, took it to a proper place of burial. So what Matthew is responding to is saying, no, actually not. You need to know that when someone is condemned and placed in a tomb set aside for executed criminals, there is a custodian, there's a guard placed. And you can't do that. You would never be able to get away with it. And so that's what Matthew is pointing out. And there is historicity behind it. It's so obvious that I think Mark and Luke don't even bother with it, but Matthew makes a point that there is a guard and the disciples can't do that. And so what happens with the Gospel of Peter is he, whoever this author was, builds on the guard at the tomb, and that he expands that to include lots of people at the tomb, not just the guard, but Jewish elders, and indeed the whole city of Jerusalem comes running outside and is on hand at the tomb when this spectacular resurrection takes place.
So why are these Gospels of Judas and Peter important, even if they are quite obviously non-canonical?
Well, they're very important because they document what people are thinking, what the issues are, what the objections are, the challenges, the questions, and so on, admittedly in a later time. The second century is huge. Like, why did the early church settle on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? I mean, that's the ultimate question that lurks behind Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Why these four Gospels and not these others? Well, because we do have, surviving from antiquity, other Gospels like Peter and Judas, it helps us answer that question. And I have students ask me that. Do you think that Professor Evans, did the church make a mistake and leave out some writings that ought to be included? I always say, well, why don't you read those writings and you come back and tell me. And when you read Judas, when you read the Gospel of Peter, when you read the Gospel of Thomas and so on, you know, it's always obvious, wow, the church made a very good choice, because these later writings don't reflect the realities of the early first century. They don't exhibit verisimilitude. The authors are not familiar with the land of Israel, the topography, and so on. It puts us in a position to appreciate that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are very well written, very accurate, and the church wisely chose to include them instead of these other ones.
Finally, then, with about a minute here, someone says, I simply didn't know that these other Gospels existed and that they were ancient, not perhaps as ancient as the canonical Gospels, but that they were this old and they were floating around. They begin to ask that question your student asks and simply wonders, well, did we get it right? How would you respond to that person?
Well, that's why I say read them and you tell me. It's so obvious. There's a lack of realism. There's outright ignorance, outright factual and historical mistakes. I think the author of the Gospel of Peter isn't sure which Herod is involved. Is it Herod the Great, or is it his son Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch? And so these Gospels can be subjected to critical scrutiny and study, and of course it becomes clear that they don't know what they're talking about. And so that makes us appreciate all the more the earlier Gospels, which are in the New Testament, and those authors knew what they were talking about and portrayed a very realistic and very historical Jesus.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. Next time we'll talk with him about the sexual Jesus, straight, gay, or married, and Jesus in popular tradition, Islamic tradition, and rabbinic tradition. Dr. Evans, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
In hour two of Issues Etc., Elaine Donnelly will kick it off for us. We're going to talk about President Biden's policies and the U.S. military. He's already made some decisions and issued some executive orders that will directly impact the military. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Alan Carlson of the International Organization for the Family about demographic trends on fatherlessness and childlessness, two things that go hand in hand in the degeneration of the American family. And Joy Pullman of The Federalist will be alongside to talk about what you should know about using or not using the Google search engine.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois invites you to an open house from 1 to 3 on Sunday afternoon, January 31st. Take a tour, visit with faculty and administration, and find out more about financial assistance and scholarships. For more information, visit the Facebook page for Metro East Lutheran High School or call 618-656-0043. Open house at Metro East Lutheran High School, Edwardsville, Illinois, Sunday afternoon, January 31st.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.